Loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker. Russia and Syria have opened three humanitarian corridors in the city of Aleppo. How would the Syria army's retaking of Aleppo change the course of this five-year-long war? South Korea has denied entry to and deported two Korean-American peace activists who traveled to the country to participate in protests against the deployment of THAAD, the U.S. missile defense shield in South Korea that has generated mass anger inside of South Korea and harsh condemnation from Russia and China. While Korean authorities detained and deported the Korean-American peace activists, other Americans from Veterans for Peace were able to make it into the country, and they are joining Koreans in protest all over the country, including upcoming actions in the town of Sanju, the site of the THAAD missile deployment. But first, we turn to Syria. Russia and Syria have opened three humanitarian corridors in the city of Aleppo. How would the Syrian army retaking of Aleppo change the course of the five-year-long war? And what does the al-Nusra Front hope to achieve by disassociating itself from al-Qaeda? We are joined from California by political analyst Soraya Sepapur-Ulrich. Welcome back, Soraya.
Thank you, Brian. Good to be on your show.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. Humanitarian corridors have been opened in Aleppo as the Syrian army looks to retake the city. How important is Aleppo strategically?
Well, it is the terrorist stronghold. I don't like to refer to them as opposition because I don't believe opposition would engage in a fight that would take lives and create so much havoc. So I dub them all as terrorists, and I don't believe they're moderate or otherwise. And that is their stronghold, and it will really be a game changer for this ongoing assault against Syria and the Syrian people. And it's really imperative, it's terribly important that the Syrian government, along with allies such as Russia, should succeed in this. And in having this corridor for the civilians to be able to flee the terrorists who are holding them there captive, and not only are they being starved, but they're being used as human shields. So it really is inhibits the Assad forces or the Russians or Iranians, anybody else, from helping get rid of this plague, the terrorist plague that's befallen Aleppo and the whole of Syria. So it's fortunate that this opening has been created for them to leave. Of course, our representative at the UN, Samantha Powers, has been disgusted by this, which is, again, another hypocritical stance of the United States, because they did exactly the same thing in Iraq. So not to mention the post-9/11 attempts in Afghanistan, where they actually used loudspeakers to have the civilians flee when they bombed Afghanistan. So I just hope that it's very successful in getting the civilians out as much as they can, although we read already that they're trying to stop all this, the terrorists themselves. And for them to push full front ahead and recapture Aleppo.
Right. So let's talk about Samantha Power and the difference in the U.S. orientation towards, say, Iraq and Syria, as you mentioned. You said in Iraq, the United States supported the creation of humanitarian corridors, unlike in Aleppo. So talk about the difference. When you talk about humanitarian corridors, you're talking about in the retaking of Fallujah, for instance. I believe that's what you mean.
Right. So, you know, it's because in Iraq, actually, the United States does have its forces on the ground. I mean, we're now being informed that in Iraqi Kurdistan, and I do abhor using that term, but it's just so the public can understand, because I think Iraq should be one united country. The United States has deployed boots there, and so because they're already established there and they've regained the footing in Iraq, yes, they are perhaps more serious in fighting ISIS and chasing them out along with the Iraqis. But in Syria, it's a totally different matter. I think that if the terrorists were to fall in Aleppo, and I hope that happens sooner than later, then the United States has been behind this whole the activities in Syria ever since early 2000s would lose its foothold. And I think there's a very distinct difference between the two countries. America does not want President Assad to succeed in ridding Syria of its terrorists, whereas in Iraq, it does want to see a degree of stability.
The United States says it's investigating coalition airstrikes in northern Manbij that killed 56 civilians. When I say coalition, I mean the United States. Killed 56 civilians earlier this month. What's been the main effect of the U.S. airstrikes? Who have they aided?
They've always typically aided the terrorists that the United States backs, or the mercenaries that the United States backs. And it's interesting, if you look at, again, Fallujah, which you just mentioned, in 2014, in January of 2014, ISIS, and at that point they called it Al-Qaeda affiliate, the ISIS was not used. It wasn't the common narrative. They captured Fallujah, and the following month, in February of 2014, the United States sent thousands of drones, military trainers, heavy weaponry to help Fallujah. For the Iraqis to recapture Fallujah. And oddly enough, the training is such, and all the equipment, the military equipment was such, that only a few months shorter, 1,000 ISIS terrorists made 30,000 Iraqi soldiers flee. So you have to wonder, who were they to train and help? I mean, how could 1,000 people trained, not, you know, opposition, make 30,000 Iraqis flee when supposedly the United States was there to help the Iraqi army. So I think at any time, I mean, you see this in Afghanistan, you see it everywhere else the United States has been engaged in. When they're there, they're actually helping the terrorists. They're creating more mayhem, which enables the United States then to put boots on the ground. And God forbid, should Hillary Clinton be the next president, is already in the works that this is what they would do. Not they would not call it no-fly zone, which is what they did to Libya. They're calling it the no-bomb zone. And, you know, this whole helping and aiding the mercenaries, the terrorists who oppose President Assad, is to enable the United States to have the no-bomb zone and to basically take over Syria, because they haven't managed to do it through their terrorists.
Well, Soraya, I want to pursue this issue a little bit more about the difference between Iraq and Syria and what it all means, because there are different theories, different concepts, different scenarios that people who are on different sides of the political equation have utilized to try to explain what appears to be a very contradictory, almost schizophrenic situation, at least in terms of U.S. policy. But I want to just go over one possible scenario. In terms of the fall of Mosul, which took the United States seemingly by surprise, you're indicating maybe it wasn't a surprise, but I want to go over another possible way that that may have happened and contrast it with Syria. In the case of Iraq, the Iraqi army was a construct of the United States during the circumstances of occupation, and it has been patched together, its officer corps patched together, basically through corruption, through money, through bribery. And the commanders, it's possible, and this is one of the sort of reports, is that the reason they fled is that they have no will, no determination to fight, that they're not really an army, that they're really, or at least they were at that time, just a cash cow for the corrupt commanding officers who had been on the payroll of the United States. And at this first sign of battle, they fled, they left their troops, and their troops without leaders then retreated themselves. That explains, this, according to this scenario, how 1,000 ISIS soldiers could dislodge 30,000 Iraqi soldiers. In Syria, by contrast, the Syrian Arab Army is a coherent, cohesive army. The national government is still the same government. It's the Ba'athist regime. It flows from the anti-colonial project of the past decades. In other words, it really is a functioning state, unlike Iraq. In other words, instead of it being like a U.S. plan There is an inherent and fundamental weakness in Iraq that's not replicated in Syria. And that allowed ISIS to gain so much strength in Iraq in the case of the seizure of Mosul. But it's actually different in Syria. What do you think about that?
Well, that makes sense because, you know, as we know, the United States and its allies invaded and destroyed Iraq. And from the way I see it, that they have this total war concept whereby they totally destroy a country, not only its infrastructure and military, but it's a very culture down to the core, and then they want to rebuild it. This is the neocon concept, and it's dubbed the total war concept. And that happened in Iraq. So, yes, it did lay the groundwork for ISIS. The army is not coherent. It's not working together. In Syria, as you mentioned, the case is that they are very dedicated. I mean, although they're using ISIS to get rid of Assad, one of the reasons that Assad keeps gaining in popularity amongst civilians is because of ISIS. I mean, they sort of turn to him to protect them from these terrorists. But at the same time, what my fear is, although Syria is making strides, although it is being helped by Russia, Iran, and Hezbollah, one has to be very careful that it doesn't meet the same fate as Iraq, because when the United States fails in deploying its mercenaries to destroy a government, then the next step, you know, and it's already has used sanctions against it. Next step may well be aerial bombing. And then at that point, then we might see a repeat of Iraq. And this is what needs to be stopped. This is a very vital turning point for Syria. And I sincerely hope that the international community is aware that everybody really needs to be preventing the United States and its allies from bombing Syria, from turning it into another totally failed state, and from occupation.
Right. We're talking to Soraya Sepahpour-Ulrich about the fact that in Aleppo, the Syrian army looks to retake the city, and humanitarian corridors have been established in cooperation between Syria and Russia, so that civilians who have been trapped there all the time, that at first the so-called rebel forces, what you are calling the terrorist forces, which I agree with, have been dominating Aleppo. Of course, they represent a landscape, a variety of political and military organizations, but they are the armed opposition. Maybe they have nothing in common with the different units, but they have in common the fact that the United States has supported them, and they have in common the fact that they are opponents of and want to overthrow the Assad government, which, of course, was a priority for the United States as well. But this could be, Soraya, a turning point, because Aleppo is the most populous city, or was, in Syria. According to the 2004 census, of course, well before the beginning of the 2011 war, more than 2 million people lived in Aleppo, a multi-ethnic, diverse city. If this were to, if the armed opposition groups, the armed terrorist organizations were to be ousted, that would be a real game changer, wouldn't it, in terms of Syria?
It would be a real game changer, but it would not stop the United States from pursuing its plans. I don't believe that the United States would give up just because it's been defeated in Aleppo. I think it would then continue in pursuing its regime change, either through a war of sorts, again, like I said, the no bomb zone, or because I don't see the United States going back to 12 years when it started this whole uprising against President Assad. And it's already invested so much time and money and its reputation. It's not going to give up. Plus, its allies in this massacre, in this destruction, like the Saudis and the Qataris and the Israelis, will not give up. So I think the U.S., even if by chance it decided that it wants to stop its regime change, its occupation of Syria, whether through terrorists or through actually various armies, it would have to reconcile this mindset with the other countries that have been cooperating with it. So I know it would be a game changer. I think it would be a huge morale boost for the Assad government, as well as those who are allied with Syria. But at the same time, we must not for a moment give up being very resistant and not for a moment think that the worst is behind us and that, you know, we can relax. I think we should even be more on guard at that point against what may be coming.
Okay, Soraya, let me ask you about the decision or the announced decision by Al-Nusra Front that they are changing their name and formally disaffiliating with Al-Qaeda. Is this just a ploy to avoid being targeted while maintaining their same sort of fascistic type ideology? Talk about that, if you would.
I think absolutely it's ploy. If they disassociate themselves from Al-Qaeda, then they can claim they're not terrorists. They can receive direct aid from the United States and the others fighting in Syria, the opposition, if you want to call them that. So it's definitely, if you think back Afghanistan in the 1980s, you know, we had, there were the Mujahideen, and there were all different groups. It wasn't just one Mujahideen, one leader. There were different groups. And then one of them, the Taliban, that was kind of more organized, became, you know, dominated the rest of them. And at that time, well, Zalmay Khalilzad, who became the ambassador to the United Nations, worked for the RAND Corporation at the moment. And his take on the Taliban, who were these same terrorists who had rebranded themselves, he came out and said that they don't practice anti-U.S. style fundamentalism. And if anybody believes that they've changed their mannerism and they've changed their philosophy of being terrorists, then they're being naive.
Okay, we're going to have to leave it there. We've been joined from California by political analyst Soraya Sepapur Ulrich. Thank you, Soraya, for joining us. We're going to keep this discussion going. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. South Korea has denied entry to and deported two Korean-American peace activists who traveled to the country to participate in an annual peace march. The activists Hyun Lee and Jeon Ri join us now. They are both representatives of the U.S.-backed Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea. Welcome, Hyun and Jeon.
Hello.
All right. You have been just back from Korea because you were arrested or detained and then deported. What happened?
Well, at the immigration checkpoint, we were taken into a small investigation room. And after all that routine questions, we found out that there was a block on our entry, which was placed by quote-unquote central agency. And that since the immigration officers were at a lower rank, they couldn't tell us as to why a block was placed. However, they couldn't let us pass. So we were given a paper stating that in accordance with Articles 11 and 12 of the Korea Immigration Control Act, that we cannot enter or admitted to Korea.
And so you were put on a plane and sent to Hawaii.
But because we held the ticket in about a month later after our trip, it was done in Korea. We were supposed to come by to Hawaii to meet some friends. So they used that ticket to send us back to Hawaii.
Why do you think you were detained and then deported? I mean, you've been to South Korea before. You've been there for political and progressive trips. You entered without any problems. You were there to protest against the deployment of the THAAD, so-called missile defense shield, and other policies. Talk about why this time was so different.
Well, that's also a question in my mind as well. I guess in this time, we were supposed to travel with three fellow Veterans for Peace members to officially announce our statements against deployment of THAAD. And how that is bad for the, you know, environmental-wise. There was no environmental assessment investigation done. So we believe, and then also the resistance from the town of Songju residents are really, I guess, severe. So the government must have considered us to be a threat at this point. To add more voices or more power to the solidarity with Songju village.
Because you were detained and then deported, there has been a solidarity statement written by activists, Korean-American activists, overseas Koreans, obviously people in South Korea, people who aren't Korean, but people who believe in peace, who are supporting the cause of peace. There's been a statement issued in support of your delegation and protesting about the fact that you were deported once you arrived in South Korea. In that statement, it says there was a rushed agreement by the Republic of Korea and the United States to deploy the THAAD system, and thus it was a violation of the democratic rights of the people of Korea to have input. Help us understand, help the audience understand, especially since we have a broader audience in the United States and globally who may not be paying that much attention to Korea. Why is THAAD so important? Why does it represent a dangerous escalation of militarism? Why does it destabilize the region? And how did the method or the system used for the decision to deploy, how did that violate the democracy or the democratic rights of the Korean people?
Right. Yes, this is Hyun Lee. THAAD stands for Terminal High Altitude Area Defense. It's part of a large network of U.S. missile defense systems stationed around the world. Missile defense is very provocative. What it does is the aim is to give one side political advantage in the event of a nuclear war. So, for example, if the United States were to attack Russia or China in a nuclear first strike, those countries obviously will try to retaliate, but missile defense neutralizes their capability to retaliate. So it strengthens U.S. first strike capability. There was a treaty called the Anti-Ballistic Missile Treaty signed between the United States and Russia, which would have outlawed the development of missile defense systems. However, in 2012, George W. Bush Jr., he walked away from this treaty. And since then, to borrow the words of Bruce Gagnon, who is an anti-war activist who is now in Korea, the U.S. has been on steroids in terms of missile defense systems. So it's been building and stationing missile defense systems around the world. There's the PAC-3 Patriot missiles that are already in Japan and South Korea. The U.S. Navy has a missile defense program, Aegis destroyers that are positioned around China and Russia, also in around Japan and South Korea. NATO deployed missile defense systems in Poland, Romania, Turkey, basically encircling Russia. And so now THAAD, which is already deployed in Japan and Guam, they now want to deploy in South Korea. So THAAD is really part of this broader global arms race and U.S. efforts to encircle China and Russia through a chain of missile defense systems. And, you know, the U.S. and South Korean governments, they've been trying to tell the South Korean citizens, oh, THAAD is really for the defense of South Korea. But this is completely false. This is not true. The real aim of THAAD is to neutralize Chinese missile capability and also to protect U.S. military assets in the region. In 2013, the U.S.-owned Congressional Research Service released a report that stated that THAAD, if it is deployed in South Korea, would be ineffective in intercepting North Korean missiles that are fired to South Korea because they would be, because of the distance between North and South Korea, they would be flying on a low trajectory. And THAAD is for terminal high altitude missiles. You know, recently, a joint U.S. and South Korean committee made the decision to deploy the THAAD system in a town called Songju, which is a small agricultural town in North Gyeongsang province that's in the southeastern part of Korea. Many critics have pointed out that if the THAAD system is there, Seoul, the capital of Korea, falls outside of the coverage range of THAAD. But Seoul is where almost half of South Korean population is concentrated. However, they also point out that THAAD, if it's based in Sungju, it is effective in knocking out North Korean missiles fired at U.S. bases in Guam. So clearly, THAAD is not for the defense of South Korean people. It is, however, designed to, as I said, neutralize China's retaliatory capability and also protect U.S. military assets against North Korean missiles.
That was Hyun Lee. Both of these people have been deported from Korea when they tried to go as peace activists to South Korea to participate in peace activities. They've been detained and deported. We're talking to them now from Hawaii. Go ahead.
Well, we are calling it as a rushed agreement because up until July 6th, the South Korean government nor defense ministry has been very silent about the actual deployment site on THAAD. Until June, they even did not officially admit that, you know, they are in a negotiation with U.S. forces in Korea about the deployment itself. And then on July 8th of 2016 was when they announced that they officially made a decision on deployment of THAAD. And then in 5 days later, they said, there has been so many numerous speculations about which location the actual deployment is going to happen. And Sungju was not one of the places. And Sungju was decided 5 days later on June 13, 2016. Usually, as we have seen in Jeju Gangjeong Village naval base construction, government is to have a hearing with the residents in that region when they are building in military installments or facilities to discuss about environmental and social or society, the benefits and the impact. None of these hearings had happened. And in Japan's case, usually that hearing went on like for 13 or 14 times over the period of 8 months because people were not very sure that the radiation impact and the environmental assessment has not been verified on what's going to be happening to the humans and the crops around that area, about 3 kilometers, or is it going to be only the 100 meter as the U.S. Defense Ministry has confirmed or announced.
Yeah, I fully understand your view and why the statement says this rushed decision violates the democratic rights of the Korean people. As you explained it, no environmental impact, no feedback, no input from the community, from affected communities. And obviously, those affected communities may not only be impacted by radiation, but if it does become a triggering event for some sort of military action, the people who live there undoubtedly would be directly and dramatically affected. And negatively affected. I see that. Let me ask the two of you this question, because it seems as if the Obama administration, now we're in the last 6 months of the Obama administration, instead of trying to find some resolution to the ongoing tensions on the Korean Peninsula, is actually taking decisions that escalate those tensions, make it more difficult to have any kind of a peaceful resolution. Completely contrary, say, to the last months of the Clinton administration, the Bill Clinton administration in 2000, where Madeleine Albright was dispatched. There was the historic summit in June 13th. There was the seeming thaw between South and North Korea, which could only have happened as a consequence of U.S. policy. In the last couple of weeks, the U.S. government has actually identified the North Korean central leader, Kim Jong-un, as an individual to be sanctioned for economic and possible criminal sanctions as a consequence of different so-called crimes that the UN Human Rights Committee has identified, and the UN Human Rights Committee's legitimacy has been denied by North Korea. North Korea at this time, and as a consequence of the U.S. decision to sanction Kim Jong-un, has said the U.S. has created a red line and that now North Korea will understand everything, including international law, to be within the context of war law. In other words, they are preparing for the prospects of war. Why do you think the Obama administration is rushing to deploy THAAD taking these provocative actions against the North Korean leadership, actions they know will create a counter response from North Korea. Why are they going down this road?
Yeah, you know, I think we should point out that as much as the decision to deploy the THAAD system is troubling, what is even more troubling is the fact that this decision was announced 2 days after Pyongyang announced its willingness to talk about denuclearization. Bob Carlin has a former negotiator with DPRK on behalf of the United States around nuclear issues. He has a very important article up on 38 North. It's entitled, North Korea said it is willing to talk about denuclearization, but no one noticed. And he notes in this article that on July 6th of this year, a DPRK government spokesman's statement was released. And a government spokesman is sort of on the highest, you know, in the North Korea's ladder of authority. So statements at this level should be taken very seriously because they're used to signal important policies of the North Korean government. What the statement actually said, it actually outlined steps towards denuclearization of the entire Korean Peninsula. It said, if the U.S. is willing to make public its own nuclear weapons in South Korea, abolish nuclear weapons and bases in the South, guarantee that the U.S. will not bring in nukes to the South, promise not to use or threaten to use nukes against the North, and declare the withdrawal of U.S. forces that held authority over the use of nukes in the South. They indicated that if all of these demands are met, then North Korea will also, quote, take corresponding measures, and an epoch-making breakthrough will open in realizing the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. J.J. Seo, who is a scholar based in Japan, also wrote an article recently in Japan Focus, and he actually notes some of the changes that were made at the recent North Korean Party Congress, the historic 7th Congress that took place in May of this year. And he notes that there were two very important changes made there. That one, North Korea took nuclear first strike off the table, meaning its nukes will only be used for defensive purposes. And also it reversed its confrontational stance against the Park Geun-hye government in the South and said dialogue and negotiations will be the fundamental principle of inter-Korean relationship. After the July 6th announcement by North Korea of possibility of denuclearization, the very next day, the U.S. slapped sanctions against Kim Jong-un. And then 2 days later, the South Korean and U.S. governments made the announcement about the THAAD decision. You know, for peace and denuclearization on the Korean Peninsula, it's clear that the U.S. and South Korean governments need to change their course.
Unfortunately, we are completely out of time. That's a fascinating set of events in the sequence of events. Certainly, we have to come back to this topic. We've been talking to Hyun Lee and Jian Ri. They were both on their way to South Korea to participate as representatives of the U.S.-based Solidarity Committee for Democracy and Peace in Korea, but they were detained when they arrived in Korea and then deported. We've been talking to them from Hawaii. You are listening to Loud and Clear. We'll be back.
Loud and Clear. Loud and Clear.
You are listening to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker. As we discussed, South Korea denied entry to and deported two Korean-American peace activists who had traveled to the country to participate in an annual peace march and to protest against the deployment of the U.S. anti-missile defense system called THAAD. Now we're going to talk to Will Griffin. He is an Iraq and Afghanistan war veteran. He's part of the Veterans for Peace delegation. He was part of the same grouping that came from the United States to Korea to show solidarity with the people in Korea who are protesting against THAAD and against the continued military occupation of their country by tens of thousands of U.S. soldiers who have been in South Korea since 1950. There are many issues. The THAAD system, the so-called anti-missile defense shield, while organized on the pretext of preventing North Korean missiles from striking South Korea, has been widely condemned both within China and within Russia. Both Russia and China assert that THAAD isn't really about protecting South Korea from North Korean missiles, but it's about encircling China and encircling Russia with advanced radar and technology surveillance systems that have the capacity to carry out complete and comprehensive spying operations in China and in Russia against its most secret military and most sensitive military installations. But the people who went to Korea from the peace community, from the Korean American community, and from Veterans for Peace, they're there not only to discuss the big geopolitical and geostrategic issues related to the deployment of THAAD. They're there because the people in Korea, the people on the ground, the people whose towns and villages are actually being used as deployment centers, as the staging ground for these technologies, they are up in arms. They are protesting. And we want to talk now to Will Griffin, an activist with the Veterans for Peace, an Iraq and Afghan war veteran who is in South Korea with the other peace activists. Welcome, Will Griffin.
Thank you, Brian. Appreciate it.
Will, why are you in South Korea at this moment? Talk about that. And of course, we talked to Hyun Lee and her colleague who were denied entry. How did you get in? And talk about, in fact, what you're trying to accomplish there.
This is Veterans for Peace's second delegation. The first one was last year in December to South Korea. Our main objective was to stand in solidarity with the local peace activists and also to learn about their issues so we can help spread their issues, bring it back to the United States, and also help inspire international solidarity.
Talk about THAAD. What is it? Why are you opposed to it?
So THAAD is a missile defense system by the U.S. military, and they've announced that they're going to deploy it in Seoul, South Korea, in a little town called Songju, where the South Korean government has accepted the U.S. military's offer to deploy it here without consulting any South Korean people at all, or the residents of Songju, which is the location it's going to be deployed at. Veterans for Peace does recognize that this is going to not make South Korea safe, but only escalate the tensions in the Asia Pacific region, specifically with China and Russia.
Right. So talk about the other issues that you're encountering there in South Korea, because you just came from a demonstration in support of Comfort Women. Talk about that a little bit. Talk about the other parts of your itinerary, where you're going to Jeju Island, of course, which is off the southern coast of South Korea. Talk about that. And talk about, if you would, Will, for our audience, which is both a U.S. and a global audience, how you as an individual joined Veterans for Peace and why Veterans for Peace, an American peace group, is involved in this project.
Veterans for Peace, we're focusing a lot of our time in Asia lately because of the Asia pivot. And we joined the Comfort Women Rally in Seoul just a few days ago in support of the South Korean Comfort Women who were used as sex slaves during the Japanese imperial time of World War II and even before. And the Comfort Women Rally really has a lot to do with the Asia pivot. The U.S. needs Japan and South Korea to create a strong alliance. And in order to do that, this Comfort Women issue between South Korea and Japan needs to be resolved. Japan recently just announced some type of reparations to South Korea, and both countries agreed to a deal to try to solve the issue. But the issue was both governments, neither consulted the Comfort Women themselves or the organizations that represent them. If Japan was really concerned about solving the Comfort Women issue, they would also try to do reparations for the Chinese Comfort Women, the Vietnamese Comfort Women, but they've specifically pointed to South Korea to end this Comfort Women issue, and that helps push the U.S.'s agenda for the Asia pivot. Also on our agenda for Veterans for Peace, we'll be flying to Jeju Island, which is just off the coast of the Korean Peninsula. They have an annual peace march around the entire island that lasts about 5 days. It will have about 250 to 300 people. It'll be divided into two groups. One will be going to the west side of the island. One will be going to the east side of the island. We'll both march halfway around the island and meet on the north side, starting from the south side. After Jeju, we'll be flying back to mainland South Korea, where we will be going to Songju, which is the deployment location of THAAD, the missile defense system by the U.S. And we will be going there to stand in solidarity with the residents who are now protesting, and also to learn about the issues on a local level to see what kind of how the residents of the town are responding. It's really interesting because that town is known to be very conservative and in favor of President Park here in South Korea. And they recently felt betrayed by the announcement where they weren't even consulted about the deployment in their own town. After that, we'll be flying to various locations, mainly in Seoul, to learn about U.S. military bases and how a lot of bases out here have been expanding, and that an expansion has displaced whole entire villages. I'm in a town right now called Pyeongtaek, right next to a village where they were displaced by the expansion of Camp Humphreys, which began in 2004 and ended in 2010. And now they're in a lovely town where every house has solar panels and they're surrounded by agriculture, their own farms. But they are still suffering from income and unemployment problems. And the South Korean government and the U.S. military are not willing to help them in any way, shape, or form. So this trip has been an eye-opener, and we hope to bring international attention to this area.
So you'll be in Songju. The people there, as you said, are more or less politically conservative. Of course, that's a blanket statement. But generally speaking, a conservative place, a place that supported the very conservative President Park, South Korean president. And yet they're in the streets against THAAD, against the new missile defense shield. What's the main thing that they're complaining about? What's the main thing they're worried about? Why are they in the streets?
Well, the first thing is that they weren't consulted by the President Park administration whatsoever, and they feel betrayed. And they're also worried about electromagnetic waves that THAAD will be pushing on to their environment. And they also do realize that this is going to escalate tensions, specifically with China and Russia.
How about in the other parts of Korea? Are there protests? I mean, we're seeing images in the mass media here, in the mainstream media here, that there are Korean people out in the streets. I just wonder the extent of the protests, and is it a fact or something that the Korean government actually has to take into account?
Oh, yeah. Well, the Comfort Women rally is right in front of the Japanese embassy in Seoul. And that entire block was pretty much shut down for a few hours while people spoke and sang. And we haven't been to Songju yet for the THAAD deployment. That's coming up. Right now in Pyeongtaek, there is no protest going on. They just have people come and visit. A lot of children and university students come and visit and see their museum and learn about their story, so that can help them inspire them in other various places around South Korea where there are at least 15 military bases and something like 95 U.S. military installations on all of South Korea. In Jeju Island, the fight has been going on for over 6 years now. Where they hold daily protests in front of it's a Korean naval base that will have been designed for the U.S. carrier ships to be docked there. They protest every day at noon. That can hold anywhere from 20 people to 300 people, depending on who's visiting at a certain time. I was just recently there maybe a week and a half ago on my own. And there was a group of university students that traveled all the way from Seoul down to Jeju Island in Gangjeong Village. It was about 300 students out there. So it varies.
Right. I understand. Will Griffin, let me just ask you, we have about 2 minutes left. The Veterans for Peace, who are you? I mean, generationally, are you a younger veteran? Are the other people with you from the Iraq and Afghanistan war? Are they from the Vietnam War, or maybe some even from the Korean War? And how does the Veterans for Peace see its own role in this struggle?
The Veterans of Peace is a group of veterans who, through our collective experiences, learned that war does not win in the long run. It doesn't pay, and it's counterproductive. The group is mainly right now Vietnam veterans, but it does hold many Iraq, Afghanistan veterans. And our goal here in Asia specifically is to create international solidarity, international awareness, and also to bring these stories home to the U.S. to show where the U.S. tax dollars are going for the military and how it's being used, where they're displacing villagers, taking advantage of the South Korean people by making them pay for the majority of the bases of all their installations, and how they're pushing forward with this Asia pivot, which we believe the U.S. relationship with China in the 21st century is going to really dictate how global relations will act in the 21st century. Many high-ranking officials in the U.S. government and U.S. military have already recognized that the Asia pivot is going to dominate U.S. foreign policy for most of the 21st century. So if the U.S. and Chinese relationship ends in conflict, most of the world will be in conflict. But if the U.S. and Chinese relationship can end in peace and relate in peace, then most of the world will be in peace for the 21st century. So this relationship is really going to dictate how the international global system operates for the 21st century.
Let me ask you one final question, if I could. The United States and the Soviet Union, by agreement, the two victors or two of the victors at the end of World War II, divided the Korean Peninsula at the 38th parallel. And there was an agreement at that time that both sides, the U.S. and the Soviet side, would leave Korea, have its military leave by 1948. Both sides did that in 1948. But in 1950, in June 1950, the United States returned to Korea under the flag of the United Nations at the beginning of what we now know as or call the Korean War. Since that time, that was 1950, a long time ago, 66 years ago, there's been no peace treaty ending the war. And the United States troops, in contrast to the agreement at the end of World War II, still remain. There's thousands, tens of thousands of U.S. troops and U.S. military bases, and now U.S. military technologies are being implanted in South Korea that the South Korean people actually don't want. From your point of view, from the point of view of Veterans for Peace, what explains the refusal of the United States to actually leave the Korean Peninsula as the United States policymakers agreed to do at the end of World War II? I mean, the Soviets left, they never came back. The Russians who came after the Soviets, after 1990, when the Soviet Union collapsed, they're not there. Why is the U.S. military in South Korea?
A lot of it has to do with, obviously, money. Right when Obama announced the Asia pivot back in 2011, the U.S. military was on the verge of losing a lot of its budget. And the Asia pivot, it's just another method for the U.S. military to keep its high budget. And South Korea, the conflict between North Korea and South Korea is an easy way for the U.S. military to create fear in both South Koreans and U.S. citizens and to use as an excuse to use their military and personnel and resources and to keep the more than 800 bases around the world. And the seas in the South China Sea is a huge, important area for trade. Something like 40% of the world's trade goes through the South China Sea. And the U.S. really wants to control this area. And also knowing that China is on the rise economically. And this is a kind of a way to contain China.
We've been joined by Will Griffin. He is a veteran, a military veteran, and an activist with the organization Veterans for Peace. They're part of a larger delegation that's gone to South Korea. They're going to be in Jeju Island in the southern part of the country, off the coast of the southern part of Korea. They've been at demonstrations supporting the demands of the comfort women. They're going to be with the people in Songju who are protesting against the deployment of the THAAD anti-missile defense shield in their town. Well, that's all the time we have for today. I want to thank Will Griffin. We will be back tomorrow. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We are out of here.
Loud and Clear.